Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let the punishment be the crime. The footprints on the sand of time. The philosophy of the boy's rhyme. Make a man humble in his prime.
You can go up, down, or sideways. Be on death row, counting the days.
Let the punishment fit the crime. Sang the Ramones, and today on the Brian Lehrer Show, when do you punish someone to bring about a desired behavior? And when do you offer a reward? Why does the United States punish criminals more harshly than other democracies? What is punishment for? To deter bad behavior? For deserved retribution, whether it changes behavior or not? For the sake of making the punishers feel better or have a good time? Ever been to a public execution? When should we punish our kids? Our partners, ourselves, and how? Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, it's a family meeting on punishment. We have some great guests coming up, including the Chief Judge of New York State, Jonathan Lippman, who wants to stop sentencing 16-year-olds like adults. And let's begin by telling some stories of punishments you got as a kid that you'll never forget. If you have a story of punishment you got as a kid that you've never forgotten as a grown-up, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And what I'm hoping for here is a variety of punishments that parents give their kids through some of your stories. We've been collecting them from people we know to get this going and from you on Facebook, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Someone wrote, "My mother once washed my brother's mouth out with soap. But I think my mom came out the loser because my brother tells the story often to illustrate how ridiculous things got back in the day. Maybe the mom in that story, I would say, saw the movie A Christmas Story one too many times."
Over the years, I got to be quite a connoisseur of soap. My personal preference is for Lux, but I found Palmolive had a nice piquant after-dinner flavor, heady, but with just a touch of mellow smoothness. Life Boy, on the other hand.
Poor Ralphie, Gene Shepard from A Christmas Story. Anyone else out there with a cartoon punishment like that, washing your mouth out with soap? And how did it work out for anyone? 212-433-WNYC. Here's an interesting one. Somebody wrote, "In high school, I got caught drinking. My parents were really mad, but sort of just gave me withering looks and told me I disappointed them. And I remember my sister saying she couldn't believe they didn't punish me and that I got away with it. But I really didn't feel like I got away with it because they talked about how disappointed they were with me for weeks afterwards. And inside, I felt terrible, to be honest." And isn't that interesting? The parents' disappointment itself was punishment enough, I guess. I wonder if that depends on the relationship between the parent and teenager. Who else has one? Tell us a story of punishment you got as a kid that you've never forgotten as a grown-up. And I wonder if there are differences on this from country to country, too, or working class to upper class, or from religion to religion. Any immigrants want to call in on this? Here's one on Facebook from Rich, a Korean-American, who writes, "I had the good old-fashioned Korean punishment where you have to stand in the corner with both of your arms raised." Anyone else have that? Or what was the country of methods punishment for kids that's the equivalent of that Korean one, standing in the corner with your arms raised, from your country? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What punishment did you get as a kid that you've never forgotten as an adult? Here's a story, I think, from Chris in Westchester. Chris, you're on WNYC. Hello.
It's your shakuhachi playing listener that I've called in many, many times. You probably remember me.
How's your flute?
Yeah, I am playing every day. I just landed a gig at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on the shakuhachi. I'm pretty excited.
Nice. So what happened to you as a kid?
Okay, so I got beat. You know, I know these days my wife and I don't have children, but if we did, we would not hit them. It's been proven you shouldn't hit your kids. But I got beat all the time with a wooden spoon as a kid, and sometimes I'd get a smack in the face. But this one time, I was about six or seven, I was throwing rocks over our garage window, and one of them broke the window. I didn't make it over the garage. It broke the window, and I didn't tell my parents. And the next day, I was two houses up playing with my friend. My father calls me down, and I get to the driveway, and I knew I was in trouble. He picks me up by the wrist, and he beat the living snot out of me with a hard rubber hose. I mean, he wailed on me. Like, today, he would be arrested for child abuse.
So did it have an effect on you? Did it work to stop some unwanted behavior?
No, I always misbehaved. I was kind of a bad kid growing up. I mean, I turned out fine now. You know, I'm a responsible, self-employed musician with a wife and a house and two car payments like everybody else, you know. But, yeah, I was a pretty wild kid through my teenage years. And they really, you know, once I became a teenager, they basically stopped punishing me. I mean, I got grounded once or twice.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically they gave up on punishing me because they were very lax, uninvolved parents, I have to say.
Well, did the punishment increase the legitimacy of your parents' authority in your eyes, or decrease it, or not affect it?
It didn't really affect it. I mean, I just kind of, I was the kind of kid who just did what I wanted to, and that was that, you know. But that, it's just that one beating, you know. This beating has come up in conversation with my wife many times over the years. Just one of those things that you never forget because it was so severe. And again, if it happened in this day and age, and another parent on the block saw it and called it in, he'd be arrested.
Yeah. Chris, thank you very much. Things changed, and that may be one of the themes of the show as we go along here. Dan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing? When I was about, I guess, 9 or 10 years old, I probably spoke back to my mom, and she kicked me out of the house for the whole day, or what seemed like the whole day, and I basically sat out on the porch, walked around, went to the local donut shop, and then that's it. And then she let me back in at the end of the day.
So that's a punishment, kicking you out of the house. How old did you say you were?
Probably like 9, 10.
So you were too young to run away.
Yeah, I was too young to run away, but I was pretty independent. I went to like this donut shop and got myself a bagel or something, and yeah, I went back home after that.
Did it work to deter any particular behavior for the future?
Probably. I probably didn't talk back so quickly. But, yeah, I think so, definitely.
I wonder if parents would be slower to do that with older kids, with teenagers, because they're afraid they actually wouldn't come back.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it also depends on the child, you know, what kind of, like, a rebellious child, which I was not. Or, you know, it really depends on their character.
Yeah. And it's the opposite of the timeout, right? Go to your room. Stay in your room.
That's right.
Leave the house. Dan, thank you. Interesting story. Anyone else have that? 212-433-WNYC or post to our Facebook page at facebook.com/BrianLehrerWNYC. What punishment did you get as a child that you've never forgotten as we begin our family meeting on punishment today, both in the criminal justice system and in our personal lives? John in Oakland, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you. What happened?
So, well, my story is actually not a punishment my parents gave me, but it's from Catholic school. I was a hyperactive kid, so I was always in a little bit of trouble. And my worst punishment, aside from being paddled every other week, was they removed my desk from my classroom, away from all the students, away from all the teachers. They put my desk in the principal's office with a stack of books and paper, no teacher, no lunch, no recess, and I was like, you know, seven or eight at the time. And it was like 2 weeks before they put me back in the classroom. Actually, after 2 weeks, my parents found out that they did this to me and removed me from the school.
Wow. It's like kid solitary confinement from 9 to 3.
Yeah. It's really something that bothered me for the rest of my life. It was that was probably the worst thing that ever happened to me as a kid.
Bothered you how? What effect do you think it's had on you?
Well, I was very solitary in high school. I didn't give in to being taught by other people. I ended up learning on my own and teaching myself because of it, because I just felt like I couldn't depend on a teacher to teach me anything. So the rest of my life, I basically taught myself everything that I know today. And
so
now I work in the medical field.
Now you work in the medical field.
Yeah.
It really, it sounds like it backfired from the standpoint of what they were trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. Yeah, it totally backfired.
Thank you very much.
They didn't beat me.
John,
you're
thanks
welcome.
A lot. Christian in Westport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christian.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I was talking to your rep there about my mother was from El Salvador. I grew up in Brazil, actually. And one time she ordered a really fancy hand-making device. You know, it had these aluminum rods. It was really complicated. You know, as being a kid, I played with it when she wasn't home, and I broke it in half, and I hit it. And when she did find it, she grabbed these aluminum rods, and she beat me and my brother for it. And actually, my brother wasn't even at fault, but I didn't feel so bad because, you know, having an older brother, he harassed me so much, I guess I felt he deserved it. But I like to say this, you know, my mother loved me, my father loved me, and even with, you know, the occasional harsh punishment, we never felt it was undeserved.
Do you feel that that punishment, since that instance was memorable to you, that it changed you in some way, changed your behavior or anything?
Yeah, I think it probably taught me not to mess with things that don't belong to me. So I think a lesson learned.
Would you ever, I don't know if you have kids, would you ever do the same to your kids?
I do have a daughter, but I would never punish her that harshly. Truth be told, my mother had some depression problems, so it probably made it the punishment worse. But I do think people need to be very careful to know there's a distinction between corporal punishment and abuse, and it's not the same thing, meaning you can physically punish with love and without being abusive or in any way hurtful. And that's something that a lot of people have forgotten, I think.
Christian, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. It's our family meeting on punishment on The Brian Lehrer Show today, starting out with your stories of how you were punished as a child that you've never forgotten. We'll get into all kinds of questions of punishment in the criminal justice system and in our personal lives as we go here today. And Julie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Brian.
So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, or a small town right outside of Nashville, Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
Great experience growing up in the South. But my mother used to take me everywhere with her. I had an older sister, and she was quite busy with her. And so she would take me with her to the grocery store, department store, and I had a tendency to run away from her all the time. And she would get mad at me and pinch my arm. But one day, she was just had it, and she let me get lost for 2 hours in a department store.
Let you get lost, meaning she actually knew where you were, but she let you think you were lost?
That's right. That's right. So it was terrifying. I didn't know what to do. I was crying, and she had just had it. She had reached that point, and I never forgot that, and I never left her side again anytime we went to the store.
So looking back on it, was it too much?
Was it too much? Good question. I don't think so at the time. And granted, we didn't live in a big city, so I think that there were minimal risks to what could have happened to me, especially based on the size of the store. But I don't think so. I think I was a terrible four-year-old, and that's what I needed. And
4 years old. Oh, I didn't even register that you were 4 years old. And she left you in that much psychological terror for so long.
She did. She did, but it definitely worked, and I have to say I probably haven't left her side since I was 4 years old. So
I don't know if that's cruelty or if it takes just an incredible amount of strength on the part of a parent to –
because
she was suffering. Right, and she had to be suffering knowing that you were suffering, being so afraid if she was really kind of gaming out what you were experiencing there.
Right.
How long can you let your child go through that kind of fear, even if you think you're – setting her up for greater good? I mean, that takes some steel gut on the part of the mom.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. That was her.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Charles in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. What's your story?
Okay, so for a brief period in the I was born in the late 50s, and for a brief period in the early 70s, my father and older brother and myself moved to Spain. This was during the years of Francisco Franco was still alive. And I was fairly new in public school back then, which in Madrid, which was run by Jesuit priests, the public school was. And I remember going, we had an appointment to get a haircut, and I was late because I was probably goofing off or hanging out with friends. And when I got there, sat down in the barber's chair, my father asked the barber to shave my head, which he did.
The barber shaved your head.
Correct.
You got shaved bald as a punishment when you were 12.
Exactly.
So did this work to deter future lateness? This was for being late, right?
Well, this was for being late to the the hair cutting appointment. No, it did not work. Interestingly enough, I then became probably the most interesting or coolest kid in my high school class because I was the one with the shaved head, and I wore a Moroccan skull cap that I had bought previously on a vacation.
So you're the one who started it.
I'm the one who started it.
Because that was long enough ago. That was before the bald look was in. Well, you know what you should have done? You should have gotten out and gotten a mohawk wig.
I don't think they had them available at that time in Francisco Franco, Spain.
Would you do it to your kid?
Never. Never in a million years. And I've had two kids that are now in college or going into college, and we never disciplined them in any harsh of a manner whatsoever. And they've turned out to be fantastic kids.
I have to say, it sounds like you survived the experience, but that one sounds bizarre to me. Charles, thank you very much. Douglas on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. What punishment do you remember?
In 1981, I think I was 15 at the time. Whatever I did, I don't remember, but I'm sure it was stupid. I was not allowed to go to a Rolling Stones concert at Madison Square Garden.
No music for you. No rock and roll.
Yes. And then to show you how well I learned my lesson, the following year, I did something stupid again, and I was not allowed to go to the Simon and Garfunkel concert in Central Park.
Uh-huh. No folk music for you. That's really a punishment. You really have to be bad to get docked from folk music. So But what did you do? I mean, did you remember what precipitated these punishments?
I do not. All I could tell you was I was a rotten child growing up, and I'm quite certain I deserved whatever punishments that were given to me.
Wow. That's pretty heavy for having missed the Rolling Stones. Would you do that to your kid, dock them from whatever concert they want to go to?
I certainly would. If they did what I did, which, again, I don't remember, but I'm sure I did something stupid. If they did something stupid, they should be punished. And
there's a man with humility, Douglas on Staten Island. I don't know what I did, but whatever it was, it must have been bad, and I deserved it. Douglas, thank you very much. And Sharon in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How were you punished?
I was a slob when I was a kid, and constantly inveterate slob, and it drove my parents crazy.
Usually the boys' territory.
Yes, but I was, kind of a tomboy, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it made them so crazy that finally they resorted to confiscating my things. So they would basically come in with the parental equivalent of a backhoe and scrape up whatever was on the floor and dump it in those large brown paper bags that were the grocery bags.
Oh,
then,
yeah. Uh-huh.
Staple them shut and then label the date. And depending upon the infraction, it was like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, sometimes even a month later.
Oh, they confiscated the stuff.
Confiscated. So there was like a little inventory in the attic sort of lined up about, the date, the due dates when I would get my stuff back. And because I was, in fact, such a slob, I didn't really keep very good track of it. And one time, the thing that was confiscated was my left shoe. And
whoa.
I had, my school shoes and my sneakers. That was it. And so I don't know what happened, but I guess I grew and whatever. The next year came. 30 years later, when we were clearing out my parents' house in the attic, I found a paper bag that was still stapled, and it said Sharon's, and I won't use the word, but it begins with an S and ends with a T.
No kidding.
And it had the date. And I opened it up, and there was my left shoe. And I was like, oh, my God,
oh
I
my
wondered
God.
Forever.
And you've walked with a limp ever since.
And, now I'm a parent, and I was today, literally, before I heard the subject of your call, I was sitting down to write up the parental penal code for my house to get the kids to, understand the consequences so that the punishment does fit the crime.
And would you do the same thing?
I'm toying with it. I am toying with it.
There is a risk. I'll tell you, Sharon, I've done a version of this, not nearly as extreme as your parents, but if, my messy kid leaves stuff in the common area and doesn't clean it up after being asked repeated times, then it's, if you don't clean it up your way, I'm going to clean it up my way.
Yeah.
But that basically means going in a bin in his room, and then he's got to sort it out.
Right.
But, of course, the risk of locking the stuff away as you know, I can attest from experience as to what's in those slush piles, is some of it's homework.
Yes. Well, I think you have to have a homework, you know,
oh,
exception.
Separate. Yeah, it's homework exception, which means the parents have to go through it.
Sometimes there's a, you know, preservation of the flesh factor, like when there's Legos involved. You know, stepping on that is not fun for anyone.
Great story, Sharon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And those are some of your personal punishment stories. We'll talk next about the criminal justice system with the Chief Judge of New York State, Jonathan Lippman, who thinks there is one group in particular who we punish too much. It's our family meeting on punishment on The Brian Lehrer Show. It's our family meeting on punishment on The Brian Lehrer Show. We'll talk to a historian of punishment coming up. Right now, we're very pleased to have with us the Chief Judge of New York State, Jonathan Lippman, who's been advocating for a change in the way the state punishes 16-year-olds. Hi, Judge Lippman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. My pleasure to be here.
What happens with 16-year-olds today?
Well, we're only one of two states in the country that treat 16-year-olds as adult criminals. And I believe that when you treat kids as criminals, you stand a strong chance of making them into criminals. And this is the worst thing that we can possibly do. Kids are kids. They do silly things. We don't treat them as criminals. It's a mistake. Recognizing that adolescent brain development is different than adults. Kids don't weigh risks and consequences. So that's why I think that it is long, long overdue, 50 years overdue, that we raise the age of criminal responsibility in New York to 18, as so much of the country already has.
Well, you say kids do silly things. In our last segment, we heard about kids who didn't clean up their room, kids who were late for haircuts. You're talking about kids who are coming to court for one reason or another.
Yeah, these are kids who may do graffiti, or they may jump a turnstile, or they may do, you know, other things that are crimes. And crime does have consequences, but if the consequence is to take a kid who has a nonviolent violation of the law and treat them as an adult criminal, and actually, in the worst-case scenario, actually sending them, incarcerating them, I think society and our government is making a terrible mistake, because scientists, the Supreme Court of the United States, we all understand that children are different. Their minds are not fully developed, and they don't think the way we do as adults. And it doesn't mean that we totally say, hey, listen, you can get away with anything. But we certainly, to me, the worst thing you can do is to throw them into the adult criminal justice system and ultimately even possibly incarcerate them tough on crime. It's being silly on crime. And because kids are silly, we as a society and as a criminal justice system, we don't have to be silly. And we are the adults, and we should understand what's best in the long range for our children, which are our greatest resource. You know, what we do today by treating 16-year-olds as adult criminals is we're taking away the American dream before they even get there. We're treating them in a way that can result, and I'm not saying it always does, but can result in our actually becoming adult criminals.
Judge, did you say that New York is one of only two states in the country that automatically tries 16-year-olds as adults?
Yes, North Carolina is the only other state, and even they are on the verge of reform. So for New York to be in this position, you know, Brian, 50 years ago when we had the Family Court Act in New York, for the time being, they decided to make the age of criminal responsibility 18. We were going to study the issue, and more than 50 years later, we're still studying the issue, which for a state like New York, a progressive state, is totally wrong and I think counterproductive.
Listeners, should New York stop treating 16-year-olds as adults automatically when they have contact with the criminal justice system? 212-433-WNYC. Anybody listening have a story of being or having been 16, or maybe you had a kid who was 16 who got in trouble with the law and things turned out worse because they were treated as adults rather than as juveniles? 212-433-9692 for the Chief Judge of New York State, Jonathan Lippman, who wants to change that. And we can go beyond this narrow question to a broader one, too. Has American society gone too far in punishing teens as adults? Have we gone too far in locking people up or punishing people in general when they're young in our criminal justice system? And also, we'll get into this, how do you see race as a factor in this conversation? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Judge Lippman, do you see race as a factor in this conversation?
I think that our society is one that has that as an upfront issue that we deal with. I think sometimes it plays into the equation and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, what we strive for in the criminal justice system is that we are blind in terms of race, gender, orientation, et cetera.
We know young blacks and Latinos get the brunt of this, right? 16-year-old.
We would be totally holding our hands over our eyes to not realize that so great a majority of young people interacting with the criminal justice system are black and Latino, and that's a fact, and that's not something that we guess about. And the question is, you know, why is that? Are there societal reasons? Is it policing reasons? Is it the policies of the criminal justice system? There's no easy answers, but what I know is whether someone is black, Latino, white, whatever, treating them in a way that is counterproductive to the goals of society is so wrong. And I give you an example of something that cuts across all lines in society. We have often, when young people are convicted of a crime, that crime tars them for the rest of their life, even if it's a nonviolent crime, even if it's something that they don't do jail time for. And that's why we have in addition to the legislation we're seeking to raise the age of criminal responsibility, we also have a bill to expunge criminal records of people who often do something wrong in their younger years. And we think when it's nonviolent, we have a bill that says after 7 years, you should expunge a single misdemeanor conviction. And what I mean by expunge is it's not when you apply for a job, when you want to go to school, it you would not have to give that as a conviction. And for 10 years for a nonviolent felony after you do it, if you have no other convictions, we think it should be expunged under the same principle that you don't want to let one mistake that someone makes as a young person just ruin their lives.
Right.
And that's why in our bill on treating young people as juveniles and not as adults, under the bill we have, they don't have a record when they come out.
And
there's no criminal conviction.
It's
like we have in the family court today, that there's no convictions. It's the same thing, whether it's ensuring that you don't have a record in the first place, or after the fact, when you've been a good citizen, when you make a stupid mistake as a young person, let's clean up your record, because what are we about as a society?
Really, and this is very, very much in the news these days. As I'm sure you know, there are big campaigns underway to ease up on nonviolent low-level young offenders in various ways, the Ban the Box campaign, as it's known, so potential employers can't have that box on every job application for the rest of your life that says, have you ever been convicted of a crime? You're talking about expunging after 7 years, 10 years.
Yes,
some people would go farther.
Our bill is very much in the same vein, that whether it's housing or schools or jobs, why are we doing this? What is the societal purpose to it? And that's exactly right. I think it's the more enlightened view. I think it's the scientific view that tells us we do things when we're younger that are just due to, again, our adolescent brain development is not as full and mature as an adult.
And
when we do something, we are expected to understand the risks and the consequences of what we do.
And there's the campaign.
Younger people don't always weigh things in that way, and it's because their brain is not fully developed.
I think we're at a moment of big societal rethink, I believe, on this, Judge. I think you're part of leading a movement here. There's the campaign that we didn't mention yet to make sure ex-felons can vote again after they've served their time. They can in New York State, but not in some states. Cory Booker and Rand Paul are on that together in the U.S. Senate. In New Jersey, Governor Christie just this week made bail easier for low-level offenders because too many poor people, often teenagers, were actually spending time behind bars after their arrest for little tiny things.
Well, let me say, Brian, we have the other bill that we have, which I'm so happy you brought up, is a bill about bail, where we think it is crazy that people can't make $500 bail and they're kept incarcerated and it works against them in the criminal justice system. They're nonviolent. They're not a threat to flee the jurisdiction. Why are we doing that? So what our bill provides is it changes the presumption. Instead of the current statutory framework where the presumption is that essentially you go to jail if you can't make bail, our presumption, what we propose is if you're nonviolent, if you're no threat to society, you should be out on the street, whether it's you can do things like a supervised release program. But the reason why our system to some degree doesn't work is it's a profit motive system. The bail bondsman doesn't make money on $500 bail. And poor people can't make it, can't get from the bail system a bond, and they stay in jail, they lose their job, they're separated from their family, and it's all, again, I think you're right, it's part of a new way of thinking about these things. Look, I'm the first one, as the chief judge of this state, to tell you that when people are a threat to society, we incarcerate them. And when people commit violent crimes, we put them in jail where they can't hurt people. But why we extend that to young people and people who are no threat to anybody and play such a negative role in their lives to have the criminal justice system do that, that's not the purpose of what we do.
Are you saying that the bail bondsman lobby is more powerful in Albany than you are?
Well, I don't know if I hope not, but certainly the bail bondsman lobby does not particularly like the bill that we have. And you know what, Brian, I say this sincerely. I'm not, my goal is not to make them the target or to put them out of business. But if you're telling me that a poor person who hasn't, again, is not violent, shouldn't be out on the street with his family and in his job because they can't come up with these minimal amounts of bail, something is wrong with our system. And the bail system in New York, the pre-trial justice system in New York must be changed. It's backwards. People should be with their families in their jobs unless they're going to hurt other people.
Here's...
And if they are, then we keep them incarcerated. And do you know that the bail system in New York is so backwards that even on the other end of the spectrum, the judge is not permitted to consider public safety in the decision as to whether or not to give bail. So on both ends, it's crazy. Hmm. The judge can't consider public safety to protect people. And on the other side, you have people who wouldn't hurt a fly and are staying in jail because they can't make, you know, $500 in bail. And there's something wrong. You know, when we put out that bill, the New York Times had a headline and the article saying, the chief judge says bail system in New York, unsafe, unfair, and that's what it is. On both regards, it is wrong, it is backwards, it is, to me, antiquated, and we have to change it, and we have to change our view of how we treat juvenile offenders, and we have to change our view when someone commits a crime at a young age. We shouldn't punish them for the rest of their lives.
And that discretion on the part of a judge to take public safety into account is exactly part of the bill that got signed into law in New Jersey this week. So somehow Chris Christie has gotten out ahead of New York State on this.
There's no question. You hit the key word, Brian. Discretion, judicial discretion is what one of the things that we think is so important. The public has nothing to fear when criminal justice issues are in the discretion of the judge. Look at the Rockefeller drug laws. We argued for many years, give judges the discretion to lessen these draconian penalties for very, very small offenses with small amounts of drugs. We need the discretion. And eventually, the legislature in New York came around to that way of thinking. And on all these other issues, juvenile justice, bail, expungement, we need some positive, forward-looking thinking that looks at the world as the way it exists today, and not has some rigid view of what's soft or what's tough on crime. Right. We have to be smart on crime.
Well, here's how much
question that all of these things are, again, of one common piece that says what is society's interest in a lot of these criminal justice issues that affect incarceration, our young people, whether you keep people in the criminal justice system or let them out on the street to be with their families.
Right.
This requires some thinking that's in keeping what modern criminal justice theories are, and I think New York should be at the forefront of those efforts and not lagging behind.
The Chief Judge of New York State with us, Jonathan Lippman. Let me go broader on that question of modern criminal justice theory. As Chief Judge in New York State, do you get philosophical on this? Do you ask yourself, what is punishment for? And would my grandfather have answered the question the same way?
Oh, absolutely. Our job is to think out of the box. I think the judicial system knows a lot about criminal justice issues and about punishment and all of the myriad of issues that come into play. And yes, we have to think about what we're doing and what it means, and not just, we don't say in
the court. So what is punishment for?
Punishment is for if it serves a remedial purpose. If there's a purpose that's going to impact positively on society, it's not punishment for the sake of punishment. And that's, I think, where we make our mistake.
And when we talk to a historian of punishment later on, we're going to find out that in the not-so-distant past, it was, and it is sometimes still today, for much more than that, much more than the protection of other people and the rehabilitation. It's for a retribution for its own sake, even sometimes for the entertainment or pleasure or feeling of satisfaction of the punishers. You don't have to get into that if you don't want, but we will with a historian of punishment in a few minutes.
My view, Brian, is it has to have a productive, positive societal purpose. And it's not just, I don't believe that it is punishment for punishment's sake. I think that it has to be meaningful. It can be a deterrence, Brian. And criminal justice theory includes the fact that, you know, sometimes you have to punish so that you don't have an epidemic of violent crime or whatever. You have to deter people. And you know all of the controversy back and forth about the death penalty. Is the death penalty a deterrent? Is it Does it something that stops other people from doing right. that kind of murderous, violent
and
conduct?
Even life
and
without
you know,
parole.
There are very different scientific views of that. But in New York, as in most states in the country, there is no death penalty because in our state, ultimately, there was, as you remember, the death penalty was passed a number, reintroduced in New York a number of years ago, and then the high court, my court, ruled the statute as unconstitutional for various reasons. But the point is, that's a perfect example of where some would argue that punishment is a deterrent. You cannot let this kind of conduct go unpunished. But you know what? I don't think there's any argument about whether we should let that when a young person jumps a turnstile. You know, I don't think there's a good argument that we need to put that person in jail so that it can be a deterrent to other young people and not to jump turnstiles.
And I want to say, I want
to the modern way of thinking is you give that kid some help, you get him into a him or her into a community program that helps him, helps his family, and that that young person becomes a productive citizen.
I want to say,
I think there are good arguments both ways
before,
on certain really high-level kinds of violent conduct and what you do about it and when you punish and when you don't, and certainly violent crime is a threat to our society, and we don't want people who are going to hurt other people
right.
Walking the streets. But many of these issues, Brian, are just not controversial. They're simple. You take someone who is convicted of some white-collar crime or whatever as a young person that didn't hurt anybody, that was a mistaken judgment, and then you say 10 years later that you can't go to school
right.
or you can't get into...
And, Judge, before we run out of time, I want to say one other thing as you frame this around teenagers about why I think race matters here historically and why perhaps we're coming to a more enlightened conversation about this now. I remember the 90s when teen violent crime was high and the tabloids would publish photos of dark-skinned young New Yorkers and call them super predators. That was a term for minors who committed violent crimes, super predators. And in that era, some of the tougher sentencing laws were passed. But when those suburban high school shootings, like at Columbine, happened,
yeah.
the same media asked, how are we failing our kids? What's wrong with us? What's wrong with society that kids are randomly shooting up their classmates? The white suburban shooter kids were presumed innocent, presumed to be outcomes of society, while the black perps were super predators responsible for their own behavior like aliens from a horror movie. That's an old story, but I think it applies, and maybe we're becoming more enlightened than that now.
Well, I think that's true. I think today we do hopefully ask the tougher questions, but, you know, we changed our laws, Brian. In those years that you're talking about, our laws became that young people who committed very violent crimes, and that's not what we're talking about in the bill
right.
that we have before the legislature. If you commit murder in New York at 13 years of old age, you could be treated as an adult criminal. For rape and assault and serious violent crimes at 14 and 15, you can. So society and the criminal justice system and our public officials reacted to those crimes at the time and with a certain response. Today, we're reacting maybe in these other kinds of crimes with a more thoughtful, less, what should I say,
a
rigid a response. But I think you're right that look, we certainly believe that the criminal justice system should be blind when it comes to race, and yet we know that a great part of the crime is committed by and against minorities in our state. And how do you respond to that? Look at all the, without getting into the details, because some of these cases, you know, come to our courts. Look at all the controversy about stop and frisk, about broken windows and all of that. So, of course, you're right that race matters,
yes.
And we have to understand it,
and
we have to see that our reaction goes considers that and yet goes beyond that,
right.
And look at people as human beings and not as black or white. And this is certainly the way we want the scales of justice to operate.
And there we have to leave it.
We want it to be that everyone gets a fair shake, a fair deal, that the courts are the one place where you can go, that you know you're always going to get on the merits, you're going to get justice. But what is justice, that abstract term? We have to make justice concrete for each and every young person and for every adult in our state.
And, Judge, I have to jump in because we're out of time, but I really want to thank you, Chief Judge of the State of New York, Jonathan Lipman, who started by proposing a new bill that would stop treating 16-year-olds automatically as adults in court when they're brought up on charges. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Brian. My pleasure.
And I've worked on every cell block now, and things are going good. But then they transferred me to LS Unit 1.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and it's our family meeting on punishment today. Coming up, advice for how and when and if to punish your kids. But first, let's go wide and go deep about this. What is punishment for? How much of the purely practical goal of deterring more bad behavior or separating out people who are a present threat? And how much for the morality of retribution for its own sake? And how much for the satisfaction of the punishers? Executions used to be big public spectacles. Western society has really changed on this over time. Why? We have a great guest now, David Garland, not our own WQXR music host David Garland, another accomplished David Garland, NYU sociology professor, and author of books like The Culture of Control, Punishment and Modern Society, and Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition. Professor Garland, thanks very much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Happy to join you.
Historically speaking, what is punishment for, and has it changed much over human history?
So, you know, one of the basic purposes of punishment that we never talk about is really essential always, which is this. Anytime you have a rule, and you want the rule to be more than just a suggestion, it has to be sanctioned. It has to have a consequence. So basically, the primary function of punishment is to make rules bite, to make them serious and make people pay attention to them. That's true in a family. It's true in a school. It's true in a legal system. So that's the basic thing, to enforce rules. But beyond that, punishments have been used for all sorts of purposes, primarily to defend the public, to assert sovereignty of the monarch, to exact retribution. One of the basic background things we've got to remember is that whenever someone does harm to someone else in any context, there's a kind of reciprocal wish to do harm back. And so one of the basic concerns of punishment has always been that kind of retributive, you know, harming back the person who's violated the rule.
And you're
but
right.
Beyond that,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
All sorts of other purposes are added on the whole time.
And you're right, for one thing, that punishment is sometimes for the gratification of the punishers, like the spectacle of public executions in the past, compared to how we try to hide it and soften it now with quiet, lethal injection killings. How do you explain public executions and the entertainment value, if that's the right term, or the social
right.
place of them in this country or in Europe in the past?
So when states began to form, in other words, when rulers claimed to monopolize control and violence and law in a territory, these rulers, like some failed states today, had to, as it were, establish their capacity to rule and demonstrate to people that they were indeed in charge. And in the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries, many new states didn't have much in the way of a police force or a civil service or an apparatus. So what they did was they used public ceremonies. And sometimes the ceremonies were coronations or triumphs after a military victory. But a standard one was the punishment of offenders. And the punishment of offenders by the ruler, by the prince, by the state had to take place in public because its whole point was to demonstrate to the onlookers, demonstrate to the state's enemies, but also to the subjects, the citizens, that the state was indeed in charge, that it could project its power, it could enforce its rules. And so public punishments, which were often much worse in the 17th and 18th century than they'd been in the Middle Ages, became spectacles of, you know, Baroque intense violence in order to make a show, in order to, as it were, theatrically display a power that was really just being claimed for the first time by this ruler. Now, over time, the need for states to display their power as opposed to just use it routinely and regularly in a way that everyone understands, that has diminished. And so at the same time has our tolerance for public violence by the authorities. So you get a kind of sense that at one time, a punishment, in order to work, its function had to be public, had to be a spectacle. And then as time passed, as states develop, you know, police forces and armies and civil servants and the kind of capacity to rule routinely in a bureaucratic way, the need to punish in that public way disappears.
Listeners, what do you want to say or ask about the history of punishment, especially in Western society? But we can go more cross-cultural than that, too. 212-433-WNYC for NYU sociologist and historian of punishment, David Garland, 212-433-9692. People, what's important to know or what are you curious about regarding our changing relationship with punishment over time? Or if you come from another country or another culture, what about the evolution of punishment where you came from and what is seen as legitimate punishment today compared to the past? In any part of the world that you're from or that you're familiar with, call in for immigrants on this too, can be part of it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Professor Garland, let's talk a little bit about the history of the death penalty as an example of our changing relationship with punishment, not just public execution, but execution at all. And you've written, and you remind us that 300 years ago, organized societies used the death penalty for a wide range of offenses and offenders, not just murders and murderers. Can you give us a sense of that range?
Sure. Well, in colonial America, for example, the authorities would punish with death or with sometimes with symbolic death, where someone would stand on a scaffold and have a noose around the neck, but actually be released after a while to symbolically suggest that they'd be punished that way. But death was used for moral offenses, for religious offenses, for offenses against masters and against employers or against law enforcement officers, as well as against, you know, murderers and rapists and more serious offenders. And the reason for that wasn't just that colonial American governments were barbaric any more than the other governments around the world were at that time. It was that they lacked a range of other effective measures. So, for example, what we rely on now routinely would be fines that are enforced, probation and supervision, but most obviously imprisonment. And the prison is, if you think about it, a kind of an institution that has to be built and run and established and staffed that takes public funds and takes a certain kind of level of organization. And these didn't develop in the modern world until really the 18th and 19th centuries. So the reliance on corporal punishments and capital punishments, which we look back on now and makes it seem like these societies were as savage or barbaric, also had to do with these societies had, you know, scarce resources for control and management of the populations.
You've written about why the U.S. keeps using the death penalty when almost all other Western democracies have abolished it. And you conclude that it has a lot to do with the nature of democracy in the United States versus that in Europe, for example. Can you explain?
Well, that is true. One of the contexts you have to put this in, the bigger picture, is that America retains the death penalty today in 32 states, the federal government. But America is also, on nearly every dimension, a remarkably punitive state and society. That's to say that the numbers of people imprisoned, the rate of imprisonment, the severity of the sentences, the disqualifications that follow on sentences, All of these things are also much more severe in the USA. And that's a big story that no one's really ever explained, you know, in the same way that why is the USA a more unequal nation than most of the other comparable Western ones? Why does it have a less developed welfare state? So the big picture is that the U.S. punishes more than other nations do, including retaining the capital punishment system. Now, the reason that we retain the death penalty in, I guess, 32 states and the federal government is partly because the whole process of choosing penal laws and choosing punishments in this country is much more politicized and much more local than is true anywhere else. Basically, all the nations around the world that have abolished the death penalty, about half of them have, nearly all the developed countries have, the abolition of the death penalty has been done from the top down. That's to say that a national government, a national elite, occasionally a Supreme Court, has decided that the nation as a whole ought not to have capital punishment. And the reason they ought not to have it is, one, it's no longer necessary. Two, it has these counterproductive effects of glorifying state violence and destroying bodies that makes modern sensibilities squeamish and appalled. And so since it's no longer needed and no longer acceptable in large parts of the world, they've abolished it. And they've abolished it in every case, even though the population, a majority of the population, want to retain it. Now, abolishing the death penalty in that kind of
and can I just stop you for
difficult in the USA.
Yeah, and that's exactly your main point here, I think, right?
Yep.
That democracy actually functions different here in a more populist way in the United States.
Precisely. The decisions about having the death penalty or not, first of all, are state decisions. That there are 50 states. Each of them has the control over having the death penalty or not. And about half of them at various times have abolished it. Sometimes they've abolished and reinstated it. But the more important thing today is that the majority of states either have abolished it or else do not use it. And the states that continue to use the death penalty, that's to say impose death sentences and actually execute murderers, that's the only category of offender that's really exposed to death penalty today, they are about 12 or 13 states, mostly in the south or the southwest of the country, and even they impose it very, very rarely. So, for example, last year we had about 14,000 homicides in the country. Of all these 14,000 cases, about 43 individuals were put to death. So even for murder, even for homicide, the chances of being put to death are now infinitesimally small. Plus, the people who are put to death, in the southern states typically, meet their execution on average 14 or 15 years after their conviction. In other words, even in these places that we sort of think of the death belt of the country, the capital punishment system is incredibly hesitant and ambivalent and reluctant. Yeah. In other words, this looks a lot like a punishment that's time has passed, but it's hanging on. And it's hanging on, I think, because of the political valences, because of the popularity, especially in places that have high homicide rates, places that are divided, places that have kind of, I guess, large kind of enmities between one group and another. That's the kind of context in which you find the death penalty continuing to be used.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio, our family meeting on punishment on The Brian Lehrer Show today. Our guest right now, historian of punishment, NYU sociologist David Garland, and Enos in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Enos.
Oh, hello, Brian. Can you hear me?
Thank you
for taking my call.
Yep, we got you.
Yeah. I want to ask the speaker whether he was familiar with Foucault's favorite thinker, Nietzsche, and in particular a text, one of the last he'd written, called Genealogy of Morals. I'm not a great Nietzsche fan, but I'm a fan of this text.
And what idea of that do you want to bring out?
It explains in detail like a Western history of punishment and how it's a random, serves generally no social good, and also it draws like a link between Christianity and the idea of punishment and that resulting in a sort of systematized a bad conscience. And he compares it to Greek civilization, how Greeks didn't have that bad conscience.
Thank you very much. And David Garland, I know you function on this high concept level, right?
Well, actually, Nietzsche on this is pretty straightforward. The essay that the caller is talking about, second essay, The Genealogy of Morals, talks about punishment as being ripe with utilities of every kind. And Nietzsche says that if you want to list them, there's about 20 or 25 different things that we do with punishment. Everything from, you know, having triumphs and celebrations and spectacles to trying to educate people, to communicate with them, to deter them, and so on. And what he says about punishment is that it's one of these relationships between the powerful and the powerless that actually shapes how it is undertaken. So when we think about, you know, how we punish African-American males today in the USA compared with others, or how we punish juveniles compared to how other countries do it, what Nietzsche would say, and I think he's right, is that that reveals the relationship between the authorities and the group being punished, and it reveals the value that is being put or is not being put on the worth of these people. But Nietzsche was a great one of thinking in terms of, you know, our will to power and our recognition of other people's value. And one of the things he said was that the stronger the state, the more authority it has, the more real power it operates, the less it needs to punish. Basically, it can command obedience and manage the population all by itself. In the same way that you have a family that's very strong, or a schoolroom that's being very well disciplined and very well run, you never see punishment being used much. Basically, you know, the regular modes of management and control, people obeying the rules, people complying with the program, people doing what they do because it works for them and they enjoy it, in that context, punishment's never used. So one of the things I would want to ask is, what's wrong with the USA and a society that we have to punish so much?
Ken in Massapequa, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, great show and perfect segue for my question. I'm curious to know if there's been times in history or cultures that have been particularly successful in prosecuting and punishing people in power and rulers. And the reason I ask my question is because I think one of the main problems we have today is this disconnect when we have organizations and people who are too large or too powerful to prosecute and punish. Now, I'm not a big believer in punishment, but I think if there is a case for it, this is the case today, and that it destroys the trust and integrity we have in our society when there are people that clearly can just get away with literally murder or anything else.
Well, that's so – I think this is such an important call. And what Ken raises, Professor, is something that we hear over and over and over again on this show that I think goes to the question of the legitimacy of punishment as administered in our society today. Because as you raised and as we talked about earlier on the show and with so many guests lately, Cory Booker, lots of others – you know, the rate of incarceration of young black males, especially in this country, is, you know, through the roof. At the same time, nobody went to prison for anything having to do with a financial crisis, you know, and people ask why. And yet people call up with a kind of punishment lust, right? So people call on the one hand to say we punish too much and too harshly, some people in society, and we don't punish other people who are just as deserving or more deserving of punishment enough. And when there's that level of a disconnect that's perceived by the people, then the legitimacy of the state starts to erode.
So that's exactly right. And the kind of populist calls for the powerful to be punished, to be sent to jail and so on, partly that's to do with the lack of trust between citizens and government. Partly it's to do with the kind of frustration that you're describing about the impunity of the powerful. But what you have to remember is that in all circumstances, in all societies throughout time, across the globe, punishment is a power relationship that flows from the powerful to the powerless, right? Basically, punishment is one of the ways in which authorities impose their power. So it's not surprising that, by and large, they're not imposing it on themselves. The time that you see state officials and high ministers of state being punished typically is after a revolution or a coup d'etat when one group takes over from another group. But that being said, the fact that, you know, mostly punishment will be moving towards the lower socioeconomic ranks than the top ones, different societies have got very different success in terms of managing the law-abiding, trustworthy, corruption-free character of government. And one of the things that's really striking as somebody who's moved, as I have, from Britain to the U.S., is that the very high level of exposed corruption that appears in this country. Now, I don't myself think that the answer to that has to do with punishing more. I mean, basically, the people that get punished are the ones that get caught, the ones that have poor lawyers, the ones that leave a trail of evidence against them. Mostly the societies that are well-run and non-corrupt at the top, places like the Nordic countries, for example, or Northern European countries, or even Canadian states and federal government, they tend to secure that culture, not by the threat of punishment, but by training and professionalism and incentives, and particularly by avoiding the overlap between money and politics. And it seems to me that that's one of the major fault lines in U.S. government that exposes so many serving officials to temptations, to illegalities, and outrages so many members of the public when they do it.
Let me just ask you one other thing real quick as a historian, as a segue to our next segment, which is about prison in particular and the effectiveness of prison as a punishment mm-hmm. in our modern society. We have a very special guest, Piper Kerman, who wrote Orange is the New Black, mm-hmm. and we have Glenn Glenn Martin from the Fortune Society coming right up to talk specifically about prison. But historically, how did prison become sort of the universal punishment?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like that's what we do now for everything. We separate people from society, from their physical freedom.
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, we bracket that by remembering that most offenders that come through, say, the New York courts are actually misdemeanor offenders. They don't go to prison. They get fined. They get death tickets. They might get probation. But you're right. For serious crime, for felonies in this country, prison is the absolutely standard answer, and we imprison a huge number of people. That came to be in a kind of surprising development at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. One of your callers mentioned Michel Foucault before. Foucault explains this the following way. He says that basically all the prison reformers who were trying to move away from capital punishment and corporal punishment and banishment had a whole bunch of different ideas about what they should do. Public works, analogous punishment, symbolic punishment, very few of them thought the prison was a good idea. But the prison turns out to be, in lots of respects, the apparatus that best captures the way modern institutions work. So if you think about a monastery, a military barracks, a schoolroom, a factory, they all operate in modern society with the same kind of mechanisms of surveillance and order and discipline and control of individuals within the institution, within the enclosure. And basically the prison is a way of putting into an enclosure, behind the scenes, out of sight, out of mischief, any of the unruly individuals that society can't otherwise cope with. Now, what's really interesting, I think, is that some societies can cope with their offenders. Basically, families are strong, welfare institutions are strong, employment is extensive. And so juveniles, for example, or young offenders, or people who do drugs, or people who are beginning on a life of crime, they can usually be managed in the community while still at home, which, of course, is the cheapest and most effective way of dealing with people. In the USA, to return to this kind of remarkable level of imprisonment here, in the USA, we don't seem to have the social resources, the strong families, the strong welfare states, the strong employment even, to absorb people who are getting into trouble into the mainstream community. So instead, what we do is we write them off. Basically, we imprison and jail people. And one of the things that we know, and I'm sure your guests will discuss this later, is a prison sentence is really an expensive way of making bad people worse, because being in prison actually predicts for being in prison again, not being able to get a job, having family breakdown, earning no decent money afterwards. Prison is one of these things that should be a last resort to deal with somebody, you know, where we've tried every other mechanism or they're dangerous to the public. In the USA, imprisonment is standardly a kind of a first resort for somebody who is a felony offender or a repeat offender. And that seems unnecessary when you look around the rest of the developed world.
NYU sociology professor and author of books including The Culture of Control, Punishment and Modern Society, and Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition. David Garland, thank you very, very much. It's been so fascinating.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
It's our family meeting on punishment on The Brian Lehrer Show. And next, when does prison work? With Glenn Martin from the Fortune Society and Piper Kerman, who wrote Orange is the New Black. Stay with us. But then they transferred me to LSU in one. Swing low, swing low, swing low and carry me home. Trap, trap, trap till the cages fall. It's our family meeting on punishment on the Brian Lehrer Show today, in the home, in the courts, and right now within the prison walls. Let's talk to two people who have been incarcerated, who now talk very openly and forcefully about that experience. Glenn Martin spent 6 years in New York State Prison. He's a founder of the Fortune Society, which fights for criminal justice reform, and now head of his group, Just Leadership USA. And Piper Kerman spent a year in women's prison on felony money laundering conviction. She wrote the book Orange is the New Black about that experience. And, of course, there's the Netflix show of the same name. She has also become a strong advocate for prison reform herself. Glenn and Piper, welcome back to WNYC. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you. Glad to be
here.
Hello.
Thanks.
And Piper, I understand from your vacation cabin, so thank you for taking the time.
Someone else's vacation cabin, but I'm happy to be here.
And Glenn, in our office, when we talked about doing a segment like this, we were referring it to it as with quote-unquote ex-cons. And then we were wondering about the language of that and defining someone, especially someone who's out, by that label. Do you have a preferred language when referring to someone who's been in prison? Because that term still gets bandied about easily.
Sure. I think any sort of language that rehumanizes the folks that we're talking about works for me. Using the language of the system to describe people in the system, convict, prisoner, ex-con, and so on, really just serves to dehumanize folks. Department of Corrections tends to use this language to be able to other the people who are serving time so that there's a huge distinction between the human beings that are there to do their job and so on and the inmates, convict, ex-offenders, and so on. It's a lot easier to put an inmate in a cell for 23 hours a day than it is to put a person.
And can you talk a little bit about your personal experience, what you were sent to jail for or prison, if you're comfortable with that today? And did it feel like it was about making you learn a lesson to change you for the future, to make you less likely to be a repeat offender, or simply to remove you from society, to protect other people from you at the current moment, or, you know, something even lower than that, like somebody was getting their grins?
So I went to prison about 20 years ago, and my initial offer was 20 to 40. So the first thing I want to say is that the first time I even had a sense of what sort of time I was facing was well beyond having the handcuffs on. So the idea of deterrence, I'm not really sure about that component of the criminal justice system, because two things. One, people who are out there committing crime don't tend to follow legislative statutes as they change from year to year. Two, most people who commit crime have no intentions of getting caught, so they're not thinking about deterrent effect. But I went to prison, and, you know, the first thing I noticed was that mass incarceration is like the biggest joke on the American public, because while I was there for a robbery where no one was physically hurt but still defined as a violent crime according to New York State statutes, the biggest joke about mass incarceration is that there were so many people there for much less serious offenses for four, five, six times the amount of time I was serving.
But that's mass incarceration. That's a social analysis. What about you? Did it deter you from doing it again because you did not want to go back to that place?
Yeah, you know, what deterred me from committing crime again was access to education. I happened to have the opportunity to earn a 2-year liberal arts degree while I was in prison. And it was the experience of being able to essentially travel more in prison than I ever did growing up in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, that changed my outlook on the world and where I fit into it. And probably more importantly, allowed me to humanize people who didn't look like me, who didn't come from the same socioeconomic status as me. So it's hard to transgress against other folks when you have a better sense of how you fit into the fabric of society, how you fit into the American dream. And the fact that other people have the same feelings and the same sort of aspirations and hopes and goals as you do.
Piper, people who've read Orange is the New Black know something of your experience or seen the show and that version of it. But, you know, and they would know that it's a very different experience from Glenn's in so many ways. But are there similarities, having heard his story, in which you would enter?
I mean, Glenn's story is so compelling and just offers such a clear picture of what doesn't work with incarceration and the sliver of hope that education in prison can provide. In my case, you know, I was sent to prison for a nonviolent drug offense, a first-time drug offense. And oddly, in my case, I was sent to prison for a drug offense that I had committed many, many, many years in the past. So in 2004, when I walked through federal prison gates to begin serving a mercifully short sentence, more than a decade had passed since I had committed that offense, and I was not committing crimes in the interim. So no one can claim that my prison sentence prevented new crimes. It was certainly punitive. There's no question about that. And there is no question that I broke the law knowingly. But I joined a huge percentage of both our federal and our state prison systems, which is nonviolent low-level drug offenders. And so I think one of the questions that everyone who's listening has to ask themselves is, what do we expect to accomplish from those sentences for those folks specifically? If what we expect from our drug laws is that they will lower access to illegal drugs, that they will lower substance abuse and lower addiction, those laws are a flagrant failure because basically the war on drugs and the policies around them got put in place about 30 years ago. And today, drugs are cheaper, they are easier to get, and they are more potent than they were when this sort of failed experiment was begun. So, you know, in terms of punishment and whether the punishment gets the result that we want, there are many areas in our criminal justice system where we have clearly very bad laws on the books.
So, listeners, in your experience, what is prison for in theory and in real life? Who listening now has been to prison? And did it serve the purpose for you? Many of our listeners would hope that it would. 212-433-WNYC. Did it make you less likely rather than more likely to commit more crime when you got out? 212-433-9692. And how much did the idea of punishment play into your prison experience? 212-433-9692 for Glenn Martin and Piper Kerman. And Glenn, assuming you accept prison as a legitimate institution at all, if done right, are there positive models that you would cite?
Well, you know, I have an older brother who's actually a federal correction officer for many years, and I've learned a lot from him about how he thinks about his job as someone who works within the system. And actually, when I look at the federal system, I mean, I'm not holding it out as any model. There are definitely better models in other countries that we can look at, although the United States doesn't tend to care much about what other countries are doing on this issue. But at least on the federal system, there's a level of respect between the officers and the people doing time and their families that I think lends itself to a more positive, more rehabilitative experience. There's more programming on the federal level, nowhere near enough. But if you look at the state system, the entire system is built on punishment. I mean, you can be walking on a walkway in a prison, in a state prison here in New York, and an officer is having a bad day, and you look at him or her the wrong way, and if they say, we'll see you later in the housing block, you can guarantee at some point later there's going to be six or seven officers showing up, and there'll probably be a razor blade suddenly in your plant, and you'll probably be on your way to the box for weeks, if not months. And so, you know, I think there's a huge question about the legitimacy of a system that's inherently built on this pursuit of punishment and whether or not the people who are serving time are learning any lessons about their own need to turn around and rehabilitate themselves if they're being overseen by correction officers that don't have legitimacy themselves. I remember serving on the Inmate Liaison Committee, which is a committee that engages the administration around, you know, basic needs, right? You know, towels and toilet paper and those sort of things. And I remember stacking the deck by bringing on six or seven college graduates to serve on that committee, and the administration was pissed off. And here I am walking down the walkway, and suddenly we're all in a box within hours. Within hours, we're all in SHU. And the question to me 2 weeks later was, do you want to stay here in the box, or do you want to get out of here, stop causing trouble, get off the committee, and go home?
And when you talk about the corrections officers and how people are treated. Of course, there's been a lot of reporting about that just recently at Rikers. There was that big story in the Times about how mentally disabled inmates are treated. Then the U.S. attorney said he was looking into how young inmates with mental illness are being abused. And I want to replay a caller to this show from last week that is so relevant to this conversation, because we actually got an anonymous call from someone at Rikers. I guess you can listen to the radio at Rikers Island and use a phone sometimes, talking about those abuses, but also getting at some of the larger questions of punishment. So here's about a minute of that call for everyone to hear. And just for context, he refers to the FOR building, which is the youth facility, mm-hmm. and to COs, which stands for corrections officers or guards. Take a listen.
I was in the FOR building, which is the building that houses the teenagers. It's half teenagers and half adults. They're just now trying to change that and make it all teenagers and then people over 50. But the problem is that the COs, you know, they're not trained, I mean, as everyone has said, and the kids can get unruly, and it's, of course, it's peer pressure. And what I will say is that the COs are very good about not keeping the kids separate from the adults, because they always say, you know, one of these kids could turn around and just stab you. You know, they're kids, and they're in a box, and where they're put is terrible, and they're constantly screamed at all day long. You know, it's negative energy in these kids' heads all day long, screaming, 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 you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. So eventually, they just believe they're bad, and then they just act out.
One of the callers to our show last week, calling anonymously from Rikers. Piper Kerman, want to react to that, particularly the idea of that cycle of you're bad, and then they act out.
Yeah. I think that one of the fundamentals of the experience of incarceration for any person is the struggle to hold on to some sense of humanity for yourself, and that's true whether you are held in truly appalling conditions like the ones on Rikers Island and in many city and county jails. Often those conditions are the worst conditions. Or if you're lucky enough to be in a minimum security federal prison camp, I mean, if you want to call that luck. Still, you have to hang on to humanity, because everything the system is telling you generally is that you are the worst, that you are your worst action, you are your worst choice. And so a huge part of that experience of incarceration is trying to remind yourself one way or another that you are not simply your biggest mistake, your worst choice, your least moral choice, but you are more than that. You are a more complex person. You are capable of good. You are capable of positive contribution. There's nothing about the correctional system, any correctional system that I've been in contact with, that really accomplishes that. And hence the sort of failure of rehabilitation for our prison system and the two-thirds failure rate that the prison system generally gets. Two-thirds of people who go through prison and jail will likely return to prison or jail. And so that's pretty unacceptable.
And I wonder if that limiting of the definition of somebody's humanity informed your concept for Orange is the New Black, because I think one of the things that certainly the television show does is show sort of the full range of human emotion among prisoners, even comedy.
That was absolutely my goal in writing the book, in the choice of sort of talking about my own experience and how my own life intersected with other women's lives and experiences, which were sometimes very different than mine, you know, to make that point, because that is literally how you survive a prison sentence, is your sense of connectivity to other people. And the most important thing about those connections are the positive connections, the ways in which you can contribute and ways in which you can sort of help each other. I'll make a point about the construct of a prison sentence. You know, basically, an individual transgresses, they break the law, they do something that, you know, the community doesn't like. And the choice of a prison sentence is to marginalize that person by saying, we're going to take you out of the community, we're going to put you to the side, we're going to push you to the margins, essentially, as your punishment. And then at some point, your punishment will be over, and that marginalization, in theory, will be done, though that's generally not the case. I feel like, especially for a huge swath of the population which does not commit horrific violent crimes, you know, that construct of the prison sentence takes you out of the community that you've harmed and distances the individual from the harm they may have caused. And so when you're in prison, it's all about the struggle to survive prison as opposed to a meditation on the harm you may have caused to the community. And that's a real flaw in the construct of incarcerating so many people for reasons other than pure public safety.
But then the perpetrator, especially if it's a violent perpetrator, does at least get removed from the victim, and the victim doesn't have to fear the perpetrator again or the society fear the perpetrator again in the community.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely true, and I think concerns about true public safety and violence are very valid concerns, but you have to look at half of the federal prison system and huge percentages of state systems, which are not filled with those kinds of people who have committed those kinds of crimes,
and that's the
but
point.
Rather much more low-level offenses. And so you have to question, what is the social reason that we've chosen to do that?
Let's take a few phone calls. A lot of people are calling in with their prison experiences and whether they thought they were effective for their lives and for society. And Mike in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Great. I just wanted to make a comment. You have to judge these things by the individual. Perfect example, mother and father, professional. I grew up in Newark, never had a problem, passed 3 police tests and a county police test. However, I was being bullied, and this went on for years, maybe 2 years, 2.5 years. And I was with my girlfriend. I was 20 years old at the time, and I was being bullied. And so I got into a fight, and then I picked up a pipe, and I beat this guy till he was almost near death. Make a long story short, even though that was my first time getting arrested and or locked up, I had a 5-year sentence. I did 3 years out of that. But then when I came out of prison, I didn't fear anything. Once you go to prison and you can survive prison without going on drugs or anything, you go out, you come out with a different mindset. You know you have a criminal record. You don't care anymore. You know your future's down the tubes. So you have to judge everything by the individual. I've gone to private school my whole life, never had a problem. But that one incident, you know, messed my whole life up.
Mike, was your future down the tubes, or did your prison experience and what you just described about becoming stronger actually help you to turn it around?
Well, actually, I'm still a good guy, but once you come out of prison and you figure you can take the abuse of the guards or the fighting that's in there, and you come back out into society, not stating that you'll be a bad person, but you'll take whatever comes your way. Even if something happens again, you have to go to prison again, you know you can take it. I mean, take me. I was a good, decent guy, and I had nothing to lose anymore, you know?
Yeah. Mike, thank you very much. And Glenn, to that point, people might point to you and say that you're a prime example of the fact that it is possible to be rehabilitated after you leave prison and through prison. You talked about some education you got there, yep, and you got your life on track. So why can't people take you as a positive model of why prison can work?
So people often point to me as the exception to the rule, in fact, and what I often say to people is, no, I was exposed to exceptional opportunities. So access to Pell Grants was taken away 20 years ago by Congress being tough on crime, and most college programs disappeared then.
And Governor Cuomo tried to get some reinstituted in New York State, and he couldn't get it through the legislature this year.
That is true. Some of our conservative upstate Republicans decided that the research and the data didn't matter, and that what mattered was who's deserving and who's non-deserving. But I would argue that every time a legislator is tough on crime without looking at the data and the research, they're actually being pretty soft on crime, because the truth is people who exit prison and have no place to go and nothing to do often end up recidivating. I want to go back for 1 second to Rikers Island. I'm thinking of people that might be on Rikers Island listening to this. I was on Rikers Island 20 years ago in C-74 when I had the honor of being invited to the inauguration of our current mayor. And when everyone was standing there to take a picture of him, I said, "Mr. Mayor, with all due respect, I can take a picture with you anytime over the next few years. I want to say to you, you should close down Rikers Island." And he said to me, "Why?" And I said, "Because nothing good can come from this place." And Rikers Island has not changed in the last 20 years. I'm sure it goes back even further, but I feel such a responsibility to say out loud on this radio show that those young men and young women there are sitting there idle and being abused every single day, and it hasn't changed for over 20 years.
If you close the physical facility, What do you do with the people who are arrested while they're awaiting trial?
You decentralize the jail. You put people back in the boroughs where they come from. You give them access to support services, their lawyers, and so on. Right now, the majority of people there are detainees. Let's not forget that. 13,000, the majority detainees, over 80%. And many people there for $1,000 or $2,000 bail. And lastly, 40% of the people on Rikers Island today have a mental health diagnosis.
Mike in Toms River, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
All right. You got a story.
Yeah, so I want to say, as far as jail and the deterrent, I'm a white 60-year-old male, and about 6 years ago, I had a DUI, and I spent 13 days in the county jail.
You did. As a 54-year-old white guy, you got 13 days in the slammer for a DUI?
Yes. And basically, my point is
you must have been really drunk.
I spent those 13 days in jail, and I'll tell you what, I have never had a sip of alcohol and been behind a wheel since. I mean, that was my deterrent right there, because when you go to jail for the first time, you realize you can't get a bottle of water whenever you want. You can't go get a cheeseburger. And all those simple things you take for granted are taken away. And I'll tell you what, I would never drink and drive again for anything in the world, for taking the chance and going back there. And it was only a county jail. I wasn't anything like Rikers or a state penitentiary.
The deterrent effect worked on Mike and Tom's River. And Brian in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I'm calling in because I was asked to, you know, you have experience, you can call in. I want to share that I spent about 12 years in federal prison on a 13-and-a-half-year sentence. And when I came home in 2007, I had pledged to myself not to go back. Not that I think that prison itself, I needed 12 years to be deterred from prison, but because of the overall experience and what I saw in there, it is my belief that people can be deterred, especially with the federal drug law being so harsh. I don't want to repeat this is draconian, as you hear everyone say. But I believe that the federal drug law is way too harsh, and this mass incarceration of people, you know, it didn't take, and believe I left a lot of good guys behind there with life sentences and some ridiculous sentences for a whole lot of minor stuff. I think the laws need to be individualized, and judges need to judge people individually and not on a mass scale as they're doing it. So again, my
and for you, when you got out after 12 years, did you feel prison taught you a lesson? Maybe that's too pat a cliche, or helped you figure out how to go straight, or just not wanting to go back there again?
Well, you know, I think I was on the straight path. I just deviated a little. But my getting out of prison, I've made a pledge to walk around my community and to be a support in my community to the young guys who don't get it. I was trying to use my experience to try to mentor kids in the community and make sure that they don't have the experience I experienced. Not because I think prison is a very bad place. My experience in prison, I met people who are really, I think, without a prison institution, I don't know what we would do with them in society. But I think that the time that they're giving out is just way too much to get people's attention and to focus them. I think what your guest is saying, community programs, a lot of these people, young guys, it was wasting their time in prison. They could be grabbed by members in the community and shaken up and be a more productive citizen than sitting down in prison wasting your time.
Brian, thank you very much, and good luck to you. And so, Piper Kerman, to finish up, I think we keep gravitating back toward this idea that, you know, pretty much everyone agrees with at this point, that too many people are going to prison for too many low-level, nonviolent offenses. Mm-hmm. But could you finish up on, having been there, having now studied it, done, you know, both research on it and pop culture about it, if you think there's something that makes prison good for people who do have to go to prison, some of the more violent offenders perhaps, or what makes prison as good as it could be when it is necessary?
I have a friend named Joe Loya, and Joe wrote a great memoir called The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell. He did, I think, about 7 years of Fed time and several years of state time, so he probably spent about a decade behind bars for robbing banks. He robbed about 21 banks. And he transformed his life while he was incarcerated. He spent more than 2 years in the SHU, in solitary confinement, and writing saved his life. And Joe and I were talking about this very subject, and he said, you know, because he has a lot more experience than I do with folks who are incarcerated for crimes of violence, he said, look, there are some people who just don't play well with others. And that's what we may potentially need prisons and jails for, is, you know, potentially to, you know, provide for true public safety when it comes to violence and to rehabilitate people who need a lot of help to truly succeed and be integrated into the community. What we don't want is to have fortresses where we lock up human beings for their entire lives, because it's fruitless, it's inhumane. And we know from looking outside of the United States, which happens too rarely, that there are better ways to do it.
And just to finish,
I visited exactly one prison, which is a medium security men's prison in the Midwest, which has really remarkable rehabilitation programs. And a lot of those guys are there for very serious felonies, including crimes of violence. And they treat those guys with a sense of dignity, which is very different from anything I've seen in any prison, men's or women's prison. And those opportunities include work. They include sort of cognitive behavior therapy around substance abuse, mental illness, and also the experience of violence, which is true for many of these men when you talk to them about their personal, their lives, their histories, their backgrounds. And they just create a sense of community in that prison, which is unlike anything I've ever seen. And that's the thing that everyone needs to understand about a prison or a jail, is that, like it or not, it is its own community behind bars. And it's a community sort of defined by hardship and scarcity. But there are human beings striving to, you know, embody their full humanness as they do their time.
Piper Kerman wrote Orange is the New Black. Glenn Martin is the head of Just Leadership USA. Thank you both so very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC on our family meeting on punishment today. And coming up next, we'll talk about rewards, punishments, and your kids. Stay with us.
Trap, trap, trap.
Why do you punish me? Is love a crime? If so, I'll spend a lifetime loving, serving time.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. It's our family meeting on punishment today. And while we've been thinking about punishment on a larger societal scale with our last guests, you were probably first punished by your parents right at home. And while the methods of punishing children have changed over the years, the goals haven't changed all that much. But have we learned anything? Here with me to answer your questions about effectively punishing kids is Dr. Elizabeth Guthrie, a psychiatrist and associate clinical professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at Columbia University. Hi, Dr. Guthrie. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
And listeners, if you've been frustrated or maybe more likely confused by what kinds of punishment works for your kids and have a question for Dr. Guthrie, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or maybe there's something that you found really works, 212-433-9692. And I guess, Dr. Guthrie, one pretty major question we've been trying to answer all show, whether it's in our homes or in the criminal justice system, is when punishment works, when it can be an effective tactic for changing behavior, and how. So where would you start on that big question?
Well, I think punishment is sort of one of the last things we want to do when we're talking about discipline. I'd like to pull the camera back a little bit and talk about how we get youngsters to behave in ways or comply with things we want them to do. And so reinforcing positive behaviors and ignoring them or timing them out or withdrawing our attention are very effective things to do with younger kids before you get to actually punishing them. And sometimes when we think we're punishing kids by yelling at them, we're actually reinforcing their behavior with negative attention.
Why would it reinforce? I know we hear this all the time. Why would negative attention reinforce behavior? You don't want to be yelled at.
If you grow up in a family where, you know, you get a lot of positive attention, then you're right. You don't want to be yelled at. But being yelled at is better than being totally ignored. And it's a pretty powerful thing for a child to be able to push those buttons in a parent.
If that's the choice.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it really depends on the context, on the family that the child's in.
So would you say punishment works to stop unwanted behaviors, but not to bring about wanted ones?
Yes, I think that that's probably a safe generalization to make. But, you know, I think that punishment isn't bad, but when parents are overreactive or like super lax, both of those approaches have been shown to be less helpful in terms of youngsters gaining competence and really developing and internalizing the kinds of things we want them to internalize. So, you know, both ends of the parenting spectrum are not as effective as being really predictable and consistent and having the punishment fit the crime, so to speak, right?
Yep.
In terms of parenting.
How do you know what punishment fits what crime at different ages?
Well, it really depends developmentally, right? If you're talking about a preschooler, we can't even assume that a youngster has a clue of what they're doing. And so you're worried about safety, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I tend to
get that fork out of that socket now.
Yes, exactly. Or get your finger out of the burner now. Generally, there are consequences that are very instructive to kids when they do things like that as well, like pain. But, you know, we worry about safety in toddlers. It's better to talk in school-age kids and adolescents about the punishment fitting the crime, like if a youngster, you know, drinks beer or something like that when they're underage but old enough to drive, taking away car keys makes a lot of sense and is also a very effective punishment, in addition, obviously, to maybe other things restricting their partying and such. And so having it align and prohibit repeating that behavior generally is more logical to a kid and doesn't feel cruel. Right. We want to avoid punishments that become exaggerated. And sometimes you'll see parents. I was just flying the other day and I saw a father totally lose it with his 5-year-old. And it was clear that he was just very upset about something else. And his reaction to her knocking over a suitcase was so exaggerated and beyond. And the kid was, you know, really discombobulated by it. And that's a very scary experience for a youngster to not be able to predict what's going to set somebody off.
And it erodes the legitimacy of the authority.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Tom in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to add my 2 cents to this particular discussion. As I am a father of 5 children. I have 4 boys that are between the ages of roughly, because I don't remember, 23 and 19. And I have a 9-year-old daughter. And we've always implemented corporal punishment, mostly judiciously, sometimes a little bit off the handle. But I really think that corporal punishment was very, very effective, particularly with the boys.
How much corporal punishment? Of what kind? In what circumstances?
It would consist of the dreaded wooden spoon, but we always bought cheap wooden spoons so they would break if we got too crazy. But, yes, so, I mean, if we wanted a particular sort of behavior that they were engaging in to stop and to stop immediately after being, you know, forewarned, we would use a wooden spoon on the children.
And you found it effective?
Extremely effective. Now, I'll tell you this, that with my daughter, I couldn't raise a wooden spoon to her if I wanted to. And nor does she give cause nearly to the extent that my 4 sons did. I have to, insert that. And by the way, all four of my sons, two of them are military academy graduates or A's. The other two are doing quite well in university. So they give the appearance of being well-adjusted, let's put it that way. And on the way.
And you don't think there was any other way besides the spoon that you could have brought about the desired behavior?
I'm sure there were myriad ways, but that's the way we decided to stop the behavior. That's mm-hmm. that is the technique that we decided to use. And I would say, you know, I think it's a time tried and true. Spare the rod and spoil the child is an Old Testament, for goodness sake.
Yes. So, Tom, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And, oh, boy, here we go. We could do a two-hour show on that, Dr. Guthrie. But how much were you cringing and how much were you thinking, okay, for some people, that's legitimate and it works if you don't go beyond a certain point?
Well, as a parent and I'm a child psychiatrist. I've also trained in pediatrics. I really believe that if you can avoid corporal punishment, there's lots of research out there to show that corporal punishment often ends up backfiring and getting passed along. There are certain circumstances where spanking, you know, there are different families, different cultures, different backgrounds. If it's done in an incredibly predictable, consistent way and nobody ever loses any kind of restraint there, you know, that's different. To me, when you use something like a paddle or a brush or a spoon, then that makes me less comfortable when I think about kids. But, you know, there's a huge spectrum of how people discipline their youngsters. And I think that every child is different, too. And maybe as we develop as parents and feel more competent as parents, and that might be developmentally something that happens. Obviously, there's a gender difference in what Tom was describing between the boys and the girls, and every child is different. But I wonder if, you know, part of getting physical also sometimes makes the parent feel less in control of what's going on. And we're talking not only about developing a child's feeling of competency, but a parent developing a feeling of competency and, like, the situation's in control. Some people do that with spanking. I tend to believe that if you can avoid physical punishment with striking a kid or hitting a kid or making a kid kneel on a cheese grater or making a kid kneel on uncooked rice. I think one of your bloggers wrote something about that. Then those things are extreme. Spanking is not so extreme. So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't like any physical punishment.
So, listeners, we're not going to spend the rest of the show on this, though we could. So have the conversation about corporal punishment on our comments page if you want at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. And something that we pulled from the comments page, Dr. Guthrie, is a question that a listener named Liz posted who asks, what can a parent do about a 13-year-old boy who lies and is very sneaky? Other kids report behavior that he will never admit to. We have no proof other than the other child's testimony, but similar behavior is reported over and over again. Our son will deny it and stick to his story under pressure.
Okay. So I think that it's very hard to generalize, and I would wonder, why is a kid sneaky and why is he lying? Does he have problems with impulsivity? Has there been some lesson he's learned that this is effective, or does he feel incompetent in pulling things off if he tells the truth? And if, you know, they have tried to have discussions with him where he doesn't feel threatened about it, I think it's perfectly appropriate to punish by grounding or taking away electronics or taking away some of the things, depriving him of some of the activities that he likes. If it persists, I would definitely have him seen by somebody to make sure that we're not missing something that he's reacting to, like a learning problem, like a problem with his ability to inhibit certain things, and that he's sort of doing these maladjusted behaviors to compensate for feelings of inadequacy or inabilities to achieve certain things.
Mary in Asbury Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Hi, Brian. I wanted to call because you asked about effective methods, and I wanted to mention Howard Glasser's The Nurtured Child Approach. He's written a book called The Nurtured Heart, rather, and the subtitle is Transforming the Difficult Child. And I'll just say that I think that's what gets most parents in when they read that subtitle. But really, I think it's transforming the parent who's at their wit's end. And yeah. The approach is very, very straightforward, and it's about, just as your guest said, that intense kids want relationship. It doesn't matter whether it's positive or negative. I mean, positive is better, but if you're not getting what you want, they know how to push your buttons, and they get what they need. And in this approach, he does encourage you to start right at the beginning and start noticing your child, everything and anything that's good. And sometimes that's really hard in the beginning. But it does start you in a habit of noticing and verbalizing what you're noticing. With intense kids, very often we parents are just tiptoeing around when the kids are being good. But he says, you know, jump right in and say something about that. When you get to the punishment part, and there is a punishment part, he has something called a reset. And really, what he's saying is you say to your kid, take a reset, and it's 40 seconds, 60 seconds, and you thank them for the reset. But you've made the family life so rich and so inviting through this approach of noticing
the positivity,
the positive, that the kid wants to get back in it.
Thank you very much, Mary. We have a minute left, Dr. Guthrie. I wonder, and this recalls other threads of this show today, both on the criminal justice system and on personal stuff, if you think that punishment is ever not just for behavior modification, but because a child, in this case a child, deserves it, because there's an inherent good to punishing for something that is inherently bad. We just have 30 seconds. Or is that really a religious and cultural question, and it just kind of varies from culture to culture?
You know, I think that is a huge question. And I think punishment should be avoided, but I do think that it's necessary at times when you've exhausted the other things. But as the caller just said, parental valence is so strong. Paying attention to our kids when we catch them doing good is infinitely more powerful than punishing them
when Elizabeth they're bad. Dr. Elizabeth Guthrie from Columbia University, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And that's our family meeting on punishment.